had floored ritual rooms of Emir's Cloud Palace. Jason did so again for Colin's ritual. Clive helped him pick out the one with the facilities to hose the room down afterward. He began preparations by stripping down to his underwear. No one mentioned the scars speckling his body, or the one long scar across his torso. "Is that really necessary?" Neil asked. "No one wants to see your skinny body." "This will be messy, if the last time is anything to go by," Jason said.
"It really was," Gary agreed. "We never actually cleaned that room after. We just picked up his unconscious body and snuck off."
"There's no point ruining good clothes," Jason said. "Sorry we can't all be super buff like you, Neil. Which reminds me, we need to take you to get some more flattering clothes. Seriously, who makes that stuff?"
"My aunt is quite interested in fashion design."
"Oh, I get it now," Jason said. "Is she too influential to be honest about how bad her work is, or are you all just being nice?"
"She controls a fairly good portion of the family's holdings, yes," Neil acknowledged.
"Fair enough, then. Just tell her that your team leader made you get a new wardrobe to fit in with the group."
"Since when are you the team leader?" Neil asked.
"Of course I'm the team leader," Jason said. "I have the best hair."
"Sophie has the best hair," Neil said.
"I'm the most handsome?"
"Not even top three," Neil said.
"There's only four guys in the team," Jason said, dejectedly.
"Maybe you should start the ritual now?" Clive suggested.
Jason nodded and started setting out the circle and the materials, mostly bronze rank blood quintessence gems. Jason took a razor from his inventory and sliced the back of his hand, letting Colin spill out onto the ground. The leech pile spread out around the diagram, seeming to have an instinctive understanding of where to go.
"All right, little mate," Jason told Colin. "See you again soon."
Jason began the ritual. Lines of red life force drifted out of the leeches and fed into Jason, the leeches withering into nothing. Even with that extra life force, the ritual took a heavy toll on Jason. At the edge of his vision, his mana and stamina bars emptied rapidly as mental and physical exhaustion overtook him. The little body shape indicating damage went from green to red all over as blood started seeping from his pores, spilling down his body to flow into the middle of the circle where it vanished. Once again, Jason's mind tried to drag him back to his torture, the memory of his body being ravaged by the starseed. He willed himself to stay in the moment. He felt his other familiars residing inside him. He glanced up at his friends, looking on with concern. He dropped to one knee, struggling to stay conscious. Half as much blood loss would have killed a normal person. It all flowed into the circle and vanished, until all that Jason had put in, and more, started spilling from the floor like a wellspring, inundating the ritual circle. It stopped only when it reached the edge. Crawling up out of the pool came a leech, no different to Colin's previous form. It had the same slick, wormy body and gaping maw with circular rings of oversized lamprey teeth. It was joined by a second, then a third. More and more emerged until they were being pushed out like meat from a grinder. Strips of bloody cloth emerged from the mass, gathering the leeches together and wrapping them up. Like compression bandages, they pushed the leeches together into shape, slowly binding them up into a humanoid form. The sanguine horror Jason, Gary, Rufus, and Farah had fought in that cave had taken on the appearance of a mummy. While the basic form Colin had taken was similar, it was not identical. Along with bundling the leeches into shape, the strips of cloth had formed a ragged cloak and hood, draping off the humanoid figure.
"I think it's trying to look like you, Jason," Humphrey said.
Jason didn't hear him, kneeling on the floor. His body was ravaged, and he was desperately trying to keep his mind from going back to the torture room. Once the figure finished forming, the bloody strips dried, leaving them a rusty color. It reached out to help Jason to his feet. He grasped the crude, fingerless hand.
"Colin, sanguine horror, familiar, bronze rank, swarm, hive mind. Bites from the leech swarm inflict bleeding, leech toxin, and necrotoxin.
Leech attacks drain health and stamina, allowing the rapid replacement of destroyed biomass. Ranged entangling attacks can be made using cloth strips. Grips inflict minimal constriction damage, but periodically inflict leech toxin and necrotoxin if an area with an open wound is grabbed or the target is suffering the bleeding condition. While subsumed within the summoner has accelerated healing and stamina recovery. Healing and recovery rate is determined by how much biomass was absorbed and increases with the summoner's level of injury. In addition to the changes to Colin's form, the healing he provided would now increase the more Jason was injured, the value of which was obvious. Jason had Colin walk around a little, which the familiar did, hesitantly at first, and then with increasing confidence. Its new pseudo-human guise was faster than the leech pile of its previous form, although it still couldn't move much faster than a hurried shuffle.
"All right, Colin," Jason said, wearily. "Time to come home."
Through his instinctive sense of the familiar ability, Jason could sense that he would no longer need to cut himself for Colin to enter or leave his body. He reached out a hand. Colin did the same, and the familiar was absorbed directly in through the skin. It happened in a comical rush, like a cartoon character being sucked into a vacuum cleaner. Jason immediately felt Colin go to work, helping him heal and recover. He looked down at his bloodied body and pulled out a bottle of crystal wash. Chapter 26. Nothing speaks louder than power. The return of Jason's familiars went a long way to helping him feel better. With his improved soul sense, he could feel their comforting presence within him much more strongly than before. He even retained a sense of connection when they were out of his body. It didn't match the connection of a bonded familiar, like Humphrey had with Stash, but it was enough to give him back a confidence that he had been lacking for some time. He had not yet returned to adventuring, but he did start making some social excursions. This started with Gary arriving at the houseboat to take Jason out to the Delta, to take a look at the construction site of the training annex for Rufus's academy. They rode out using two of Shade's bodies in horse form, void black but with glowing white hooves, mane and eyes. Mist shrouded each of the hooves, leaving a trail as the horses sped along the Delta embankment roads.
"So these are the horses you keep talking about," Gary said. "They're kind of like Heidels, but only having one head is weird."
"Most things only have one head," Jason said, and patted Horse Shade on the neck. Shade is quite a bit more handsome than regular horses, though. In horse form, Shade manifested with reins and saddle, but no bit. The ride was soft and smooth, as Shade was not a true animal, but a creature of shadow stuff. Shade was also able to run over the surface of water, which cut time comfortably off their journey. They rode around the huge walls marking the edge of the Geller Estate grounds until they reached the construction site. Greenstone was to the west of the estate, while the construction site was just outside the south walls. The Remore Academy training annex would primarily be made of stone, like most buildings in the region where wood was at a premium. Gary had been recruited to create metal frames and reinforcement before the stone went in, using the powers of his forge essence to create alloys heavier and stronger than steel.
"I do a lot of construction work back in Vitesse," Gary explained,
as he and Rufus led Jason around the site.
"Being only bronze rank, we don't get the freedom to go out adventuring that we get here, so it's a nice little side earner."
"Is that restrictive?" Jason asked. "It's not too bad," Rufus said. "You don't go out without a silver ranker, though. Even if your team can handle a silver rank monster, if you get a whole pack of them, a bad matchup for your team, or a gold rank monster, then your team can end up dead very quickly. At higher ranks, monsters tend to be harder to run away from."
"All that is especially true when a monster surge is due," Gary said. "The increase in silver rank monsters here is clearly a surge precursor, and in Vitesse, that increase is in gold rank monsters."
"It means the monster surge is close, right?" Jason asked.
"Maybe," Rufus said. "It could be weeks, or even months still, which is why we went ahead with construction."
Jason's friends continued to drag him out of the houseboat, to the point that he realized Arabelle herself had suggested they help Jason break out of his self-imposed isolation. He started taking his own steps out, including making use of the Musical Society membership he had purchased months ago, only to be too busy to use. Making use of his own private viewing booth at the concert hall let him get out without needing to deal with other people too much. Jason's progress was not all forward, however. Nightmares were frequent. Flashbacks could sneak up on him in unexpected moments. Arriving early for the symphony one night, something about the orchestra tuning their instruments triggered a flashback, and he fled his booth, stumbling through the hall and into one of the empty rooms around the concert hall. He was leaning against a window when he felt a familiar aura draw closer. He turned, wild-eyed, to the opening door. "Hello, Jason." Cassandra's face was filled with concern. "I saw you in the hall," she said. "You didn't look well, and your aura was all over the place."
"It's fine," he said with a grimace, leaning back against the cool glass of the window.
"I heard about what happened to you," she said softly. She stayed at a distance by the door, as if afraid of scaring off a skittish animal.
"What did you hear?" he asked.
"They put one of those things in you. Like Thadwick."
"Not like Thadwick," Jason snarled. His face flashed anger, then regret. "I'm sorry," he said. "I know your brother is still missing, but I wasn't taken over."
"I heard that too," she said. "A lot of people don't believe it."
"I don't care what a lot of people think," he said. "Everyone I care about, the opinion of, knows better."
"I'm sorry for how my family treated you," she said. "Treated us."
"They did what's right for them," Jason said. "Don't we all?"
"No," Cassandra said. "I heard about what happened in that village, too. Not many would stand up to a silver-ranked monster like that." Jason's aura was settling. Hers was a calming presence, intermingling with his in an echo of their former connection as lovers. She moved closer, slowly making her way across the room.
"Your aura is so different," she said. "I can barely recognize it."
"A lot has happened since we last met."
Her smile carried the bitterness of their last encounter.
"You got your promotion back."
"Impatience seems to be a Mercer family trait."
"It has cost us, more than once."
She arrived in front of Jason. After a brief pause, she wrapped her arms around him comfortingly, and he didn't resist, resting his head on her chest.
"We could have been something, couldn't we?"
she said sadly.
"Maybe," he said.
"Probably for the best," she said. "I would not be putting up with that beard."
Still leaning into her chest, he burst out laughing. Danielle had Humphrey drag Jason and his team to a large social gathering at the Geller townhouse on the island. For Belinda and Sophie, it was their first time attending such an event without a plan to steal from the attendees. In an elegant white dress, Sophie garnered no small amount of attention. Humphrey, who was raised in such settings, helped her navigate the new waters, adroitly driving away the sharks. If not for his social expertise, she would have had to resort to her own, which was not event appropriate. She had made sure that if it came to that, the slit in the leg of her dress would free up her high kicks.
"I robbed that guy," she said quietly, as they circulated. "And that one. Good thing Belinda is good at making disguises."
Jason found himself in an odd social position, due to the various stories and events he had been caught up in. His success in the Reaper trials, along with his closeness to the gold rankers every social climber in the room wanted to connect with, lifted Jason's prestige. The rumors floating around after his kidnapping and the aura projection incident made the waters rather murky, however. At one point in the evening, the bronze rank scion of an aristocratic family approached Jason. His breath reeked of drink, and his aura reeked of monster cores.
You shouldn't even be allowed around decent people.
He slurred in Jason's direction.
How do we know you don't still have one of those things in you? You could be working for them.
That's enough, brother,
a woman said. She stepped up to try and lead the man away. Jason recognized her as Liana Staline, a member of mid-tier aristocratic clan. She had been part of Jason and Humphrey's field assessment group, joining the Adventure Society alongside them.
Kyle, it's time to go home.
Her brother shrugged her off, pointing a finger in Jason's face.
What do you think you're doing, coming into our city? You were probably one of them from the start. I bet you set up all our people that died on the expedition.
The room went very still. The High Society of Greenstone had pushed their way onto the expedition. Sophie and Belinda were the only ones in the room other than the serving staff that had not lost someone close to them. Kyle was the only one that didn't sense the shift in the atmosphere, despite it being pointed at him. His aura senses were too addled by drink to feel the auras around the room grow fierce and hard.
You should take your sister's advice and go, Jason said, restraining his own aura. With the fury burning inside him, he didn't trust what he would do with it if he let it go. The rage he had built up over recent events was more than some drunken idiot deserved to have unleashed on him. Unfortunately, the idiot in question took Jason's restraint for weakness. Not sensing any aura, Kyle used his own aura to push down on Jason. His aura control was sloppy, but still had a bronze rank soul behind it. There was a limit to Jason's tolerance, however, and Jason's own aura rose out like a monster from the deep. It devoured Kyle's bronze rank aura projection with ease, biting down like a vast maw until Kyle felt its teeth against his naked soul. Jason stopped himself before following through with the soul attack. Kyle had become stricken with fear, and he collapsed to the floor. Jason stepped forward to stand right over him.
You should be very careful about accusing me of getting my friends killed, he said, his voice a jagged blade of ice.
Liana, take your brother home.
Jason retracted his aura, and Liana quickly shuffled off her wide-eyed sibling, his resistance now gone. Oddly, this encounter had the opposite effect of what Jason anticipated, bringing the approval of many who had been uncertain about him. In a world of adventurers, wealth and influence were fine, but unadulterated magical potency made their acquisition an inevitability. Jason's display made it clear that his potential was blossoming into capability. Danielle swooped in to lock elbows with him, reminding everyone present that she had the foresight to support him when others overlooked him.
Nothing speaks louder than power, she told him.
She wasn't foolish enough to miss a social opportunity when it presented itself, and guided Jason around the room to make introductions she had previously been avoiding. One of these was to the Duke of Greenstone, who was talking to his brother and his sister-in-law, Beaufort and Thalia Mercer.
Beaufort? Thalia?
Danielle greeted.
You know Jason, of course.
Thalia knew Jason better than her husband did, but Jason had met the man during his relationship with Cassandra.
I believe this will be your first time speaking with him, Duke.
Danielle continued. A pleasure, Duke, Jason said, shaking the man's hand. Naturally, I've seen you at various social functions, but I dare say you never noticed a little iron rancor like me.
Everyone noticed you now, the Duke said, with a wry smile.
From what he had heard of the man, Jason hadn't anticipated liking the Duke. To his surprise, he found the man very personable. He didn't seem to look down on Jason at all for his rank or station.
We've been discussing the issue of Old City, the Duke said. The infighting in the Silver family, as it looks for new leadership, is escalating into street violence. The organization built up by the late Clarissa Ventress is looking to go the same way. It was stable for a while, but her replacement isn't keeping things together and is unlikely to hold his position. Fortunately, Adris Dorgan is keeping quiet instead of fanning the flames.
If he changes his approach, however, the streets of Old City may well become a war zone. At that point, I will have no choice but to step in to restore order. I'd rather avoid that outcome so soon after the Builder cult purge.
I still say you should just do it now, before things get out of hand, Beaufort said.
Perhaps you can offer us some insight, Mr. Asano, the Duke said. You have some experience with the Big Three, do you not?
I've met Adrus Dorgan, and I like the man. I've heard good things from people I trust that know him better. I never met Clarissa Ventress or her replacement, but again, I know people that did. They were less flattering. As for Cole Silver, well, if you spend 4 days hanging from a ceiling with no pants on while a guy stands there watching you the whole time, I guess you could say you know him.
How colourful, the Duke said with a chuckle. So, what insights can you offer?
Well, Jason said, I haven't really been paying attention, so I may be missing some of the political nuance, but the solution seems obvious.
Oh? The Duke prompted.
It's time to end your hands-off approach of Old City and take direct control. At this point, Adrus Dorgan is essentially the mayor of Old City, so you might as well make it official. Between his daughter running the Adventure Society and his rising level of influence after his assistants flushing out the Builder cult, he's heavily invested in legitimacy at this point. Place him under you officially, and you've got a handle on the one man who has a genuine chance to take the pot off the fire before it boils over. It'll also send a signal to the people scrabbling over the vacant positions in the Big Three. Once they realize that era of criminal overlords is over, they won't be willing to fight as hard. There will still be crime bosses, obviously, but they won't have the power they did in the past, which will de-escalate the infighting. The Duke raised his eyebrows, turning to Danielle.
Is this you? He asked.
Danielle held up her hands in a display of blamelessness as Jason looked between her and the Duke.
You told him the same thing? Jason asked her.
She did, the Duke said.
She also used the word obvious.
That's just my uninformed opinion, Jason said. I have no doubt there would be a slew of political obstacles to navigate. And, of course, nothing will prevent the violence altogether. To be honest, I'm biased because I think very poorly of the lack of actual civilian authority in Old City. The Big Three may have done some good to keep order as a de facto government, but they are ultimately a predatory one. They operate in a gap left by the inaction of existing civil authorities.
The Duke chortled. You do realize that the existing civil authorities is essentially me.
My friend Humphrey likes to say that privilege comes with responsibility, Jason said.
He's a good boy, Danielle said.
I have to say, Mr. Asano, the Duke said, you certainly live up to your reputation.
Jason shook his head sadly.
When you're this handsome, he bemoaned, of course people are going to talk. Why won't they let a guy live his life?
Danielle ran a hand over her face.
You just can't help yourself, can you?
Chapter 27. My name is Jason Asano. Elizabeth Silver stirred when she felt something press down on her large canopy bed. There was a young, bearded man in a dark suit, sitting on the other side, cross-legged. She opened her mouth to call for her guards before stopping herself. If they could have helped, they already would have. Her bronze rank aura senses couldn't detect the man's aura at all, which meant that he was dangerous.
Hello, Miss Silver, the man said. I'm sorry to call on you so late.
What do you want?
She asked. I want you to understand that Old City is changing, the man said. The days of criminal rule are coming to an end. Other members of your family have come to understand this, but you've only seen weakness instead of wisdom and pushed them all the harder. People are being hurt, innocent people, and I'm here to convince you to stop.
So, you're one of Dorgan's dogs?
She said. No, the man said. I'm an adventurer, and I have a contract. To make people like you understand that these are new times. No one is saying you can't be a crime boss. Wiping out crime altogether would be pointless and foolish to even attempt. Having people like you retain a measure of power keeps the chaos to a minimum. But that's what you get. A measure. The days of the big three are over, and trying to bring them back will only cause more bloodshed, which I promise will include yours.
So the high and mighty island government is going to bring us to heel with death threats?
The young man smiled. If I have to come back here, Miss Silver, you'll find my mercy does not extend to killing you. My name is Jason Asano. A cold fear washed over her body as she recognized the name. Your cousin went to some effort to destroy me. I took longer than I should have to rectify the scenario, and my friends interrupted before I had my taste of recompense. I would advise against being the means by which I assuage my disappointment. A shadow rose up behind Asano, moved over his body, and he was gone. Belinda had finally undertaken her field assessment, and the team was gathered in the marshalling yard to await her return. With them was a rather nervous jury. The marshalling yard was crowded, with the many new essence users that had appeared in the wake of the Reaper trials. The drop in market price for essences wasn't a true democratization of power, but many of Greenstone's only reasonably well-off families were adding adventurers to their ranks. An adventurer who found success would be able to raise their family up with them. Normally, the crowd gathered waiting would be the families of the wealthy and powerful. This had been the case when Jason took his field assessment. Before the expedition disaster shook their faith, they had been so proud, so sure of themselves. In the wake of that, some families had realized their errors and corrected. They instituted new training programs for their essence users, frequently turning to the more successful adventuring families like the Cavendish, Mercers, and Geller clans for guidance. This helped cement such families at the top of the Greenstone pile. Other families had been looking for anywhere but themselves to place the blame, loudly decrying the failures of Danielle Geller and Elspeth Arella. They had gone so far as to seek restitution from the Gellers and the Adventure Society itself. The results of these different approaches were reflected in the changes brought about by the Adventure Society's inquiry team. The families that looked to fix their mistakes and use the people they lost as a chance to grow and improve saw their positions within the Adventure Society improve in kind. After the sweeping demotions, these were the groups that most frequently had their previous rankings reinstated. Those that made an enemy of the Adventure Society obviously fared less well. Arguably the single most powerful political entity on the planet, the Adventure Society had no time for the admonitions of some lower-tier aristocrats in one provincial city. Those families found their demotions upheld, even to suffering additional waves of demotion. Many found their family members had their Adventure Society membership revoked entirely. Oddly, the outcry of fools railing against them was helpful to both Danielle Geller and Elspeth Arella. The more they were blamed, the more clearly the blame fell on systemic problems within the local adventurer culture that neither Danielle nor Arella were responsible for. Danielle spent most of her time away from the city, and whatever revelations had come out regarding her motivations, Arella had been taking concrete steps to rectify the corruption within her branch. While the old adventuring families were undergoing changes in the wake of the expedition, the people gathered in the marshalling yard represented a new post-expedition movement in Greenstone. Where the old guard had a new sense of caution and humility, these new adventurers were filled with optimism and hope. The people around Jason's team were more aspirational than established, anxious for the return of the person they had placed all their hopes on. For many families, having an adventurer amongst them was a chance to lift all of them up. Jason knew that the reality was more harsh. Even amongst Greenstone's elite, only a handful of families were producing quality adventurers. Jason had seen the results of shattered illusions in young adventurers, like those who fell under the sway of insidious nobility like Thadwick Mercer, or criminals like Cole Silver. Such people rarely met good ends. Of those that had followed Thadwick, half had ended up dead at Jason's own hand. He took solace that some of the others had managed to find fresh beginnings, at least. Jason considered the group that had fallen under Thadwick's thumb. In the course of investigating Thadwick's shady land-grab scheme, Jason had decided the fate of most of them one way or another. The ones who had come for him before had died at his hands. Months later, he was still troubled by how quickly and easily he had turned to killing. He wondered if letting them go would have been better. But they had come for him once before, and brought larger numbers the second time. Perhaps the longer he left it, the more killing it would have meant in the end. Two of Thadwick's former lackeys had managed to find some measure of redemption. Dean was the one Jason had managed to put back on the straight and narrow. Disillusioned when his dreams of being a grand adventurer fell flat, he had been pulled into Thadwick's orbit at his lowest point. Jason helped him find his way back, and while he was never going to be an exceptional adventurer, there was still a place for him in Greenstone's Adventure Society. The other of the pair was Jerick. Where Dean had surrendered immediately that day, Jerick had fought it out and Jason had taken him alive. Rather than being tried, he had been stricken from the Adventure Society as part of the quiet covering up of Thadwick's activities. After Thadwick, Jerick had fallen in with Cole Silver. He had then risked everything to betray Silver and lead Jason's companions to him in his hour of greatest need. Whether or not it was a cynical choice to try and get his way back into the Adventure Society, Jason didn't much care. When asked for his input, he voiced no objection to Jerick's reinstatement to the Adventure Society. Jason met with him once after his reinstatement, advising him to work his way up using his own strength rather than attach himself to others. Whether Jerick took his advice or not was up to him and was no longer Jason's concern. Jason was stirred out of his thoughts by the attention his team was getting. His aura sensors detected the attention of normal people with no way to control their own auras. Humphrey and himself were both fairly well known, and his entire team were expensively outfitted. Jason had finally taken Neil into Gilbert's resilient attire for the discerning gentleman, and Neil had come out looking annoyingly good. Occasionally, someone would try and make a social approach, only to think better of it. Jason was helping this along with a subtle aura he was projecting to heighten their unease. It was a trick he had picked up from Humphrey's mother, who had been showing him some nuances of aura control normally held off until bronze or even silver rank. "Has my mother spoken to you yet about the training program she was talking about?" Humphrey asked Jason. "She's mentioned it," Jason said. "I don't hate the idea of what they're doing." Danielle and Arella had a strained relationship since the expedition, but both women recognized that, as important figures in the adventuring community, they would need to put aside their differences. Danielle had told Jason about a program they were looking to develop, offering the new wave of adventurers some basic training. The goal was to prevent too many from falling into the patterns that had put so many essence users under the sway of the Big Three. "Mother quietly thinks they can change the entire tenor of Greenstone's adventuring culture," Humphrey said. "She and the director seem determined to have something good come out of their shared mistake," Jason said. "I have a lot of respect for that."
"What do you think?" Humphrey said. "Are you going to join in?"
"I'm not sure I'm qualified to teach anyone anything," Jason said. "This time last year, I didn't even believe in magic."
"It's just fundamental aura control," Humphrey said. "Are you seriously going to stand there, using your aura like that, and say you can't teach someone the basics?"
"What's she roped you into teaching?" Jason asked.
"Basic martial technique. She's roped in a bunch of people. Hasn't she, Sophie?"
"If the Adventure Society is paying, I'll take it," Sophie said.
"I've agreed to join in too," Neil said. "Not to teach anything, but make sure Sophie's instruction doesn't kill anyone."
"I'm not responsible for other people being weak," Sophie said.
"Actually," Jason said, "if you've agreed to teach people to fight, you're directly responsible for them being weak." She tilted her head thoughtfully.
"Huh. I guess you're right."
The first wagon full of would-be adventurers arrived in the marshalling yard. It was a large intake, so they had gone out in separate groups.
"She's going to pass, right?" Jory asked nervously.
"Of course she will," Sophie said.
"Right?"
"Right," Neil said. "She has her full set of powers, and she's been on a road contract. She's more qualified than any of us were for our assessments."
"So what next?" Neil asked. "Back to adventuring?"
"We need to be looking for the right contracts, ones that will get us to bronze," Humphrey said. "The hardest iron rank contracts we can find, plus any bronze ones we can get. Now Jason is back to 3 stars, the application process to claim a bronze rank contract is much simpler."
"We can do that?" Neil asked.
"It isn't done in Greenstone a lot," Humphrey said. "Beth Cavendish and her team have been taking some bronze rank contracts since the Reaper trials. The approval process is a pain unless you have a 3-star, which she is."
Groups of would-be adventurers started arriving, including Belinda's. She dashed over to share hugs with Sophie and Jory.
"Any problems?" Jason asked.
"I'm quietly confident," Belinda said. "I thought Vincent would go easy on me, though. Aren't he and Rufus a thing?"
"The fact that he didn't go easy on you is the reason he and Rufus are a thing," Jason said. "They're both big on integrity." With the whole team officially on the Adventure Society rolls, they threw themselves into contracts, with an eye to raising their abilities. Belinda and Sophie had the most abilities in need of raising, so the team put them forward more than the others. Aside from Clive, each member of the team had their own new powers to master, though. Clive was the closest to hitting bronze. He had been an adventurer the longest, and possessed the accelerated advancement speed of a human. He was quietly letting the others take the forefront in the training, not wanting to reach bronze yet. If it was possible to access the Order of the Reaper's astral space, it was most likely that the iron rank restriction was still in place. Once inside, they would all be free to hit bronze rank, as some of the Reaper trial participants had done the first time through. Leaving the space had not been an issue for them. For Jason, it was his familiars that required the most work. But his real attention was on Path of Shadows, his shadow teleport ability. He had only told Clive that there was a chance of finding a way back into the Order of the Reaper's astral space, and Clive had been quietly working on the issue, using information both from Emir's people and from Shade. The Iron Rank contracts were a chance for Belinda to keep cutting her teeth on Iron Rank monsters, since her abilities were at the lowest level on the team. They continued the technique they had learned from Henrietta, of mixing up combinations of team members and solo operations to push her into using different powers. The team was always on hand to step in if something went wrong. The others sought out large groups of Iron Rank monsters, or Bronze Rank ones, when they could get them. Humphrey and Jason would even take them on alone, both having powers that could bridge the rank gap. As the mild desert winter moved almost imperceptibly into spring, the team took an unconventional contract. East of Greenstone, inland beyond the desert, lay the Veldt. The people there were hardy and tough, beyond the reach of the desert astral space and its oases. They rarely called on the Adventure Society, but had sent word to Greenstone that a group of essence user bandits had taken up in their area. The inhabitants of the Veldt kept mostly to themselves, and even when it came to monsters, they usually handled them on their own. The use of every essence found by the loose-knit band of communities was collectively decided on, with a small group of local monster hunters serving them all. They would only turn to the Adventure Society in Greenstone if something beyond their abilities turned up. The people had an isolationist pride, but also a practicality born of hardscrabble survivalist principles. As the group was led by a bronze ranker and had too many essence users for the locals to deal with, the bandits had taken over a whole town, killing most of the residents and enslaving the rest. They had started raiding the other small towns of the Veldt, trading loot and slaves to the nomadic tribes of the north. When Elspeth Arella had offered the team the contract, Jason and Humphrey had discussed at length whether or not to take it. With the number of bandits, the remoteness of their location, and the chaos they had caused, there was no stipulation for capture in the contract. The order was to put them all down. Jason was reluctant, but Humphrey had been adamant.
Jason, those people are going to die. The Adventure Society will send someone out there to kill them, and not everyone has your scruples. I'd rather do it out of a sense of responsibility than send someone looking for the chance to kill actual people instead of monsters. Are they really adventurers that bloodthirsty? Jason asked. Yes, Humphrey said. I've heard stories from my family, been told how to recognize the signs of adventurers I should never team up with. The kind of people who will kill the bandits and then kill their victims because they can. Then they'll blame it on the bandits, and no one can say otherwise. And the Adventure Society allows this? Of course not, Humphrey said. But out in the wilderness, who's to say what happened? Every now and again, there'll be a push to implement rules about using recording crystals when the contract is to take down real people. But there's always resistance. There are some valid arguments against it, like the recording crystals being detectable. But mostly adventurers don't like anything that reeks of shackles. I can sympathize, Jason said. Eventually, Jason came around. They took a boat upriver. Then Clive requisitioned a Magic Society skimmer from the local depot, and they made their way into the veldt. It was there that they met with Keith of the local monster hunters, who led them to the bandit town. Jason had gone in alone to scout before returning to the team. He had discovered that the bandits were from Greenstone, criminal essence users from the Silver and Ventress organization. They had seen the changes coming and left the city altogether, knowing the Big Three would no longer provide them with the same level of reward. Many feared they would be held to account for past misdeeds, when they had used their power within the criminal underworld to live out their most depraved desires. Under a charismatic leader, they had gone out into the veldt, where they believed the Greenstone authorities would not follow. Without the controlling hand, however, they had gone wild. The escalating series of atrocities they carried out as they raided the local townships had quickly led the locals to call on the Adventure Society. After scouting out their town, Jason told his team that he wanted to handle the bandits alone. They immediately refused, but just as Humphrey had talked him into taking the contract, he talked them into letting him do it alone. They were reluctant, but this situation was nothing like when he had been taken by Silver. He would be fighting on his own terms, with his team nearby to provide backup if things went wrong. The town, he argued, was perfectly set up for him to fight using tactics that would allow him to use his abilities to their fullest. It took Jason some time to get them to come around. Ultimately, they were convinced by his determination and resolve. The unflinching hardness of his eyes was a perfect reflection of his aura. Once they agreed, their local guide was flabbergasted. "He's just one Iron Ranker!" Jason didn't respond as his shadow rose up, passing over him, and he vanished. Clive sent an expensive, long-range recording crystal flying high up over the town. A projection crystal hovered in front of them, showing what the first crystal recorded.
"You'll be able to see what happens for yourself," Clive said.
Chapter 28. While They Watch Me Kill You. The town was little more than a cluster of stone and clay buildings along a single main street. It was not the better for its new residents, with signs of essence abilities being thrown about destructively. Walls were cracked with impact rings and scorched with the flash burn signature of fire powers. All seemed quiet, with no sign of Jason. There were bandits around the town, along with some miserable-looking unfortunates that the bandits were using as slaves. The bandits sat around, playing cards or molesting one of their more attractive slaves. There were both men and women amongst the bandits, who cared more about toughness and malevolence over gender. Essences absolved any natural disparity in physical power between the sexes. There was a corpse pinned to a wall with large stone spikes. The bandits paid it no mind. Unseen in the shadows, Jason watched one of the enslaved former residents look longing at the outskirts of town, then fearfully at the dead body. Even with a head start, there was nowhere to hide in the sparse, flat terrain of the veldt. It was nothing but low grass marked by the occasional lonely tree. The bandit's languid day was disturbed when one came staggering out of a building. It was a poor village, and there were no doors on any of the buildings, which had the bandit loudly stumbling through a curtain of beads before collapsing on the ground, blood pooling under his head. His fellows rushed over and turned over the body, finding his throat cut.
"Someone killed Craig!"
Paying attention to the body, they didn't notice a pair of blood-red strips of ragged cloth snake out of the doorway the dead bandit had emerged from. Only once they had wrapped themselves around the corpse's legs were they spotted, the bandits watching in startlement as the corpse was rapidly dragged back into the building.
"What was that?" "Go get the boss while I check it out. Someone thinks they can mess with us, and they're about to have a very bad day."
One of the larger bandits flexed his muscles, dark, hard scales covering his body. Others picked up weapons or conjured them out of thin air, some wreathed in fire or sizzling with electric sparks. The one with the scales went inside, and the others heard him crashing about.
"Damn it! There's another one dead in here!" he called out,
then stormed back out of the room.
"Two of our guys are dead in there, and none of you idiots saw or heard a thing! What is wrong with you idiots?"
"Neither did you."
That earned the speaker a punch to the face.
"I said go get the boss, idiots."
He pointed out one of the bandits.
"You, go get him. Everyone else search the town. Whoever did this is here somewhere, and roust everyone out while you're at it."
Seeing the images recorded from high above, Jason's team watched as the bandits started turning over the town. They found no sign of their attacker beyond what had been left behind. Many of the buildings had dead bandits, usually from a slice across the throat or a stab wound to the back of the neck. Others looked like corpses left in the desert for weeks, their bodies dried out and rotted, when they had been seen walking around hours or even just minutes earlier. The bandits dragged the bodies out into the sandy dirt of the main street as they cleared the building one by one.
"Where is Vargas?"
"I saw him go into that building over there."
"Did you see him come out?"
The bandits began to realize that more of their number were going missing in the course of the search. They heard screams coming from one of the buildings, and then one of their number came staggering out, looking more dead than alive. The big bandit with the scales rushed over and grabbed the man's shoulders to keep him upright.
"Who was it?"
The man was barely able to cough out a response.
"Shadow, I..."
They felt an ominous aura come from the building, along with an icy voice.
"Suffer the cost of your transgressions."
The bandit holding the man up felt flesh soften under his fingers. He dropped the man as they watched his already corpse-like appearance fully rot in front of their eyes. The big man burst into the building, but found it empty. The bandit's leader emerged from the largest building in the town, formerly the only tavern, before he had claimed it for himself. He had no shirt and was still pulling up his pants, eyes going wide at the pile of the bodies in the street. The remaining bandits, the better part of 24, assembled in front of him. The leader loudly demanded to know what was going on, and a dozen bandits all talked at once, unnerved at finding almost a quarter of their number dead at the hands of unseen enemies.
"Shut up!"
the leader bellowed. He was about to make more demands when he looked behind the bandits assembling in front of him. Following his gaze, they all turned around to see four cloaked figures standing behind them in a line. One was a man in a cloak made of darkness and stars. Another looked to be made of darkness entirely. A third was wrapped head to foot in bloody rags, its hood and cloak made from dangling strips. The final figure was just a cloak, with no wearer. All that was inside it was an eye, a little larger than a head, made of what looked like blue and orange fire. Two orbs drifted around the floating cloak, slightly smaller versions of the main eye. The leader pushed his way forward through his men to stand in front of them. He guessed the man in the cloak was an actual person. The others had the looks of summons or familiars. The only aura he could sense from any of them was a bronze rank aura from the figure made of bloody rags. Unsurprisingly, the sense he got from the aura was a blood-drenched hunger.
"You killed my people?"
the leader asked.
"Yes." "Why?"
"So you would all gather in one place."
"What for?"
to kill the rest. The leader frowned.
Your Adventure Society?
Yes.
They just said to kill us instead of bringing us in, right?
Yes. The leader was worried by his inability to sense the man's aura. If the man was a strong bronze ranker, his bandit clan might be enough to kill him with numbers. If it was a silver ranker, they were all dead. Needing to know either way, he pressed his aura down on the man. The aura that emerged to block it left him almost laughing in surprise.
An iron ranker? He asked, disbelievingly. You really thought you could take us all out, and you're an iron ranker?
I still think that, came the cold reply.
Who do you think you are?
Jason Asano. Many of the bandits, formerly operating under Cole Silver, turned pale. They had all heard different stories, but it was a fact that going after Asano had brought down Cole Silver and scattered his organization into pieces. It was the very thing that brought many of them out into the veldt.
Is that supposed to scare me? The leader asked.
No, Jason said. It's meant to scare them while they watch me kill you. The bandit sneered. He pressed his aura down on Jason's, but was startled to find he might as well be throwing an egg against a rock. The sneer vanished as his aura was pushed back by a force that felt as inexorable as the dawning sun.
Kill this fool!
The leader barked, but Jason's aura flooded out and over the bandits. It clamped down onto each one, grinding their own auras into nothing. They were flooded with feelings of exposure and vulnerability. Then something sharp pricked not against their bodies, but their very souls. As if encased in a spiritual iron maiden, the bandits felt like any movement would leave them pained and punctured. The big bandit with the scales mustered his courage and lunged in Jason's direction. He immediately collapsed, letting out an alien, whistling shriek, until suddenly he stopped. Lying on the ground, he looked like he was still screaming, but was issuing no sound. His eyes were wide and watering, drenched in soul-deep fear. His whole body was rigid and trembling, as if caught in a seizure. The bandit leader looked down at the fallen bandit, then the others. They were frozen in place, skin slick with cold sweat and eyes filled with terror. He turned back to Jason.
You expect me to surrender?
Jason turned his head to look at the corpse pinned to the wall, then back at the bandit. The contract has no terms of surrender. The bandit leader's expression went hard, fierce eyes locked on Jason. Jason's perception power now included magical senses, which allowed him to detect the magic surging under his feet. He dodged aside as a thick stone spike burst from the ground in the spot where he had been standing. The spike then exploded, showering him in stone fragments. An army of short tendrils shot out from Jason's shadow cloak, intercepting any that were about to strike him. He was completely unharmed. Ability, cloak of night, dark. Conjuration, darkness, light, dimension. Base cost, moderate mana, cooldown, none. Current rank, bronze, 0.00%. Effect, iron. Conjures a magical cloak that can alter the wearer. Offers limited physical protection. Can generate light or blend into shadows. Cloak can reduce the weight of the wearer for a low mana per second cost, allowing reduced falling speed and water walking. Cannot be given or taken away, although effects can be extended to others in very close proximity. Effect, bronze. Cloak reflexively intercepts projectiles. Highly effective against rapid, weaker attacks, but less effective against powerful, singular attacks. Cloak allows gliding for low mana per second. Weight reduction no longer costs mana unless affecting additional people. Jason moved into the midst of the bandits, his movements light and quick, his cloak floating around him. The bandits didn't move, frozen by the sensation of knives against their soul and the memory of what happened to their fellow. A rack of stag horns grew from the bandit leader's forehead, and he barreled through his own people to get at Jason. One was killed by the spear-point horns of their leader, while another two were knocked down. They tried scrambling away, but then screamed a moment before falling silent, like their fellow before them. Jason and the leader fought amongst the other bandits like duelists in a statue garden.
The leader was stronger and faster, but Jason had learned to fight from Rufus Remore. Compared to that, the skills of a failed backwater adventurer were crude and buffoonish. He was all power and no finesse. If it weren't for his bronze rank reflexes, the fight would have been laughable. Colin and Gordon remained where they were, not moving to assist. Shade's three bodies, on the other hand, joined Jason and the bandit leader in dancing amongst the other bandits. Jason teleported between Shade's bodies to run rings around the bandit leader, dodging the powerful but slow attacks. It bought him the space to cast a spell or let him reposition to make attacks of his own, with his dagger shooting forward in the grip of a shadow arm. Not many of the bandits actually had aura powers. One who did had been biding her time, and when she found herself behind Jason, she pushed back against his aura and lunged at his back with her knife, imbued with electrical energy as she used an essence power on it. The instant she moved, Jason's aura crushed hers like a bug in a fist. She, too, collapsed to the ground, shrieking like the god of death had grabbed her. Human essence users typically had a preponderance of special attacks, and the bandit leader was no different. Many involved flinging fragments of earth over a wide area, which the leader did to try and catch the fast-moving Jason. He quickly realized this was pointless, as the cloak absorbed the attacks with ease. The leader tried a variety of other approaches, from conjuring and throwing hammers to hurling stone spears. As Jason continued to dance around him, the bandit's legs transformed into stag's legs, increasing his agility. Chunks of stone erupted from the ground to encase his arms in battering rams, and he sprung about on the stag legs, trying to catch and hammer down Jason. Catching Jason still remained an elusive prospect. Every time he thought he had landed a blow, it turned out Jason had hidden his true position within his cloak, the blow coming close but hitting nothing. Jason, in turn, had used a few spells at the beginning that seemed to do nothing. The bandit leader assumed they had failed, due to rank disparity. Since then, all Jason could manage was superficial wounds from his dagger, which the leader derisively sneered at. It was hardly surprising that a stealth specialist couldn't truly harm a higher ranker in open combat. The bandit paid no mind to the tiny wounds as he struggled to pin Jason down. One good hit was all it would take. It took some time before he realized something was horribly wrong. He had an increasing sense of dread, then spotted the black veins under his skin.
Poison, he spat, coming to a stop.
Disease, actually, Jason said, doing likewise. Not that it matters.
You think this iron rank crap is enough to take me down?
Yes. As the bandit lunged again, Jason once more disappeared into one of Shade's bodies, emerging at a distance from the shadow of one of the buildings. He was already chanting a spell.
Suffer the cost of your transgressions.
The punition spell withered the bandit leader's affliction-riddled body with necrosis, his muscle atrophying on the spot. He staggered in place even as Jason cast another spell.
Feed me your sins.
Ability, Feast of Absolution, Sin, Spell, Recovery, Cleanse, Holy. Base cost, low mana. Cooldown, none. Current rank, bronze, 0.00%. Effect, iron. Cleanse all curses, diseases, poisons, and unholy afflictions from a single target. Additionally, cleanse all holy afflictions if the target is an ally. Recover stamina and mana for each affliction cleansed. This ability ignores any effect that prevents cleansing. Cannot target self. Effect. Bronze. Enemies suffer an instance of penance and legacy of sin for each condition cleansed from them. Penance. Affliction. Holy. Damage over time. Stacking. Deals ongoing transcendent damage. Additional instances have a cumulative effect, dropping off as damage is dealt. Legacy of sin. Affliction. Holy. Stacking. You are considered more damaged for the purposes of execute ability damage scaling. Additional instances have a cumulative effect. The bandit leader's life force became visible, shining from within his body. It was tainted with afflictions, marked in swirls of bruise colors, ugly shades of yellow, purple, and red. The taint streamed out of the bandit leader's life force and into Jason's outstretched hand. What it left behind was shining light of gold and silver blue, sinking back into the bandit's body with his life force and lighting him up from within, shining through his skin. The transcendent light rapidly ate away at his already stricken body as the bandit leader started to scream. Jason cast one more spell to finish the job.
Mine is the judgment, and the judgment is death.
More transcendent light appeared, hammering down from above like a deity's wrath. The leader's crippled body was entirely eradicated, and Jason turned his attention to the remaining bandits.
You aren't going to just kill us, right?
One of them asked, voice strained with panic. Jason looked round the little town and saw the people the bandits had taken as slaves, watching from hiding. His eyes once again fell on the corpse pinned to the wall.
How many innocent people have you killed? Jason asked. There are adventurers heading north, even as we speak, to bring back the people you sold into slavery. In the face of that, you ask for mercy. If I took you back to the city, they would just kill you there.
Horror filled the bandits' faces as they realized they were about to die. The bandits started scattering, in spite of the fear Jason's aura suppression was still inflicting. The results were the same as those who had gone before, as they all immediately collapsed, screaming with a pain unlike anything they had ever known before going silent like the others. Jason looked over them, writhing on the ground, and took a shuddering breath. He had killed before, quite a lot now. This would be his first execution. He was troubled by how little that prospect troubled him.
Colin, he said, flatly. Feed.
Still standing by, Colin suddenly exploded like a bomb had hit him, raining leeches down onto the bandits. Caught up in Jason's soul attack, none of them screamed until Colin's afflictions claimed their lives. Jason stood in the middle of the dead bandits, held his arms out to his side, and chanted a spell.
As your lives were mine to reap, your deaths are mine to harvest.
Ability, blood harvest, blood. Spell, drain, base cost, low mana. Cooldown, none. Current rank, bronze, 0.00%. Effect, iron. Drain the remnant life force of a recently deceased body, replenishing health, stamina, and mana. Only affects targets with blood. Effect, bronze. Affects any number of bodies in a wide area. Using their remote viewing crystal, the team watched as blood-red life force streamed out of the bodies and into Jason. From above, he looked like a spider at the center of a bloody web.
Now, I'm not looking to give no offense, their guide said, but your man there seems worse than the folk he was sent after.
An opinion you'll keep to yourself, Humphrey said sharply, although his eyes didn't waver from the projection. If I hear you say that where he can hear it, you'll be answering to me.
Oh, don't worry on that account, the man said. He's going to find everyone real polite.
Chapter 29. Inherently Corrupting. The ordinary people left in the town weren't inclined to come out after Jason's display. From their perspective, the shadowy figure with the monstrous companions was demonstrably more dangerous than the bandits. Jason left, leaving the heroic-looking Humphrey and their local guide to come in and play rescuer. There was a floating barge coming to take the townsfolk away. It moved slower than the skimmer they had arrived in, and would be waiting in another town for the all-clear. Jason volunteered to go and bring back the barge.
You've done your part, Humphrey told him. Clive can go back in the skimmer.
I'd like to do it, Jason told him. I could use a ride to clear my head.
At least take someone with you. Sophie isn't exactly the sensitive rescuing type.
What I'm looking for is some solitude, Humphrey. Some time to settle myself